Using Bitcoin can level the playing field for the world's poor as we work toward economic justice. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. This is where you will find the best in Bitcoin made audible. I am the voice that will read it to you. And man, that last piece we covered by Aaron Siegel was incredible. If you have not listened to that, I can't stop. It's been running through my head all weekend, basically. If you haven't listened to it yet, it's in two parts. It's Revenge of the Nodes, part one and two. That's 566 and 67 for the reads. But we are starting off this week with another read. I've actually got some non-reads lined up here for this week, finally. I've got an interview. I've actually got a few interviews on the way, but one of them should be out this week. If all goes well, and I think it's going to be a really, really good one. I'm stoked. I've been wanting to talk about this for a while. But in the meantime, to start off the week, we have another read by Bradley Rettler, actually. You guys have upvoted this on BitcoinAudible.com on the vote page, and I have delayed quite long enough to get this one out. If you remember, Bradley Rettler actually wrote the piece from a while back on, it was titled Another Way to Think of Bitcoin's Value. It was read 544 if you haven't listened to it. It is an excellent piece about the nature of value, both intrinsic and extrinsic value, and really largely how terrible our understanding of those concepts really is, and how to think about Bitcoin in the context of the real definitions, the real concepts of those terms. And author Bradley Rettler is returning with another great, precise piece on the nature of the problems of economic inequality, their unjust causes, and why Bitcoin is key to leveling the playing field. So before we dive into this, I just want to make a quick mention of the lovely sponsors that make this show possible. We've got the amazing Swan Bitcoin. They are the automatic savings plan for real Bitcoiners. If you're a Bitcoiner and you're looking for a place to buy Bitcoin, I looked up the other day the top places to buy Bitcoin in the US, and they are literally the worst suggestions on all the websites. The place is Swan Bitcoin. My stack went through yesterday. I do an automatic stack every week, and it continues indefinitely, automatically. It's a no-brainer. SwanBitcoin.com/guy for my referral. And then where are you going to keep those sats? You got to keep that shit safe, son. You need an open source, easy to use hardware wallet. That is the Bitbox O2. And for those of you who've been with me, Bitbox and Swan have been crazy longtime sponsors of Bitcoin Audible. And I use their products religiously. Bitbox hardware wallet is really a great little device. All the features you want. Desktop app is super simple. And you get 5% off with code GUY. Quickest way there is guyswan.com/bitbox. And lastly, the everything stack. The stack sats everywhere card, the fold card, and the app. The app is free, actually. If you do nothing else, just get the app. They have a spin wheel, and every day you can just get free sats for nothing. But luckily, my listeners get 20% off the fold debit card, where you can get sats back on every purchase. Check them out at guyswan.com/fold. Okay, with that, let's get into today's read, and we'll follow this sucker up with a guy's take, and this one's by Bradley Rettler, and it is titled, The Rich Get Richer and the Poor Get Bitcoin, by Bradley Rettler. Can Bitcoin solve wealth inequality? Bitcoin is a buzzword, and some argue it's a scam. But with Elon Musk's Tesla recently investing $1.5 billion into the cryptocurrency, and with the mayor of Miami considering giving city employees the opportunity to get their salaries paid in Bitcoin, the cryptocurrency could be about to radically alter our monetary system. One of the unexpected, underappreciated consequences of this move to Bitcoin could be a closing of the wealth gap, writes Bradley Rettler. Introduction. Global wealth inequality is increasing. Meanwhile, government-backed currencies, where most of the poor save their money, are devaluing each year. Poor people lack access to banking, and they can't get credit. This is at its most extreme in economies in crisis, but is true all over the world. Using Bitcoin can mitigate these problems and level the playing field for the world's poor as we work toward economic justice. Owning cash is a losing game. Between 2016 and 2019, the inflation rate of the Venezuelan Bolivar was 54,000,000%. Of course, no Venezuelan wants to hold Bolivars because they are worth less each day. For those who do have Bolivars in their bank account, banks have strict withdrawal limits. Families use upwards of 10 debit cards from different accounts and different banks just to buy groceries. Given the government's stranglehold on finances, the average person cannot easily acquire other assets, and their bolivars are also often confiscated by police or the military. This situation is not unique to Venezuela. Many countries' government-sponsored currencies are rapidly devaluing, including Turkey, Nigeria, Lebanon, Zimbabwe, Argentina, Iran, and South Sudan. The privileged wealthy in those countries have no problem weathering the storm. They've abandoned the ship of local currency for the lifeboats of foreign equities and foreign currency. The poor, by contrast, have no such luxury. They are paid in local currency, pay others in local currency, and save what they can in local currency. They lack the opportunities of the wealthy. Their ships are sinking, but they have no lifeboats. As their currencies devalue, the poor's share of the country's wealth decreases because they lack access to safer investments. Making matters worse, many countries have no banking system. For example, 76% of Kenyans don't have a bank account. They make do instead with the M-Pesa payments network via mobile phones. This works well as a medium of exchange, but not for storing value. Should the Kenyan shilling devalue beyond its current rate of 5% per year, their options are limited. The wealth gap increases. This phenomenon isn't unique to countries with rapidly devaluing currencies. It's just more noticeable. Almost every government-backed currency is designed to devalue over time. The wealthy store very little of their wealth in cash or cash accounts. The rest of us aren't so lucky. When we want to save, we save in fiat, and that is a losing play. It is very hard to stash away just a few hundred dollars in real estate. Most of us don't have a way to buy fractions of a house. One might think that apps like Cash App and Robinhood are helping people who are only able to invest minuscule amounts in the stock market. This is a sorely needed service, but it's not without concern. First, both sell their order flow to Wall Street, allowing Wall Street to use that information to front-run retail investors. Second, they both use slow, centralized clearinghouses, which can prevent retail investors from making purchases they want to make, like buying stock in GameStop. The wealthy also easily take on low-interest debt in a currency that gets easier to pay back over time and use it to buy assets that hold or increase their value. The poor cannot. They have less access to low-interest debt and so pay off debts less easily. Almost every country's currency is designed to devalue over time. This is a debt forgiveness program for the global rich, rich individuals as well as rich countries. Owning Bitcoin is better. Bitcoin can help. Whereas governments can issue their currencies at will, for example, the U.S. government printed $9 trillion in 2020, 22% of all the US dollar ever minted. This is not possible with Bitcoin. The rules embedded in Bitcoin software dictate that its supply schedule will unfold predictably until there are 21 million BTC by 2140. The supply is capped at 21 million. And Bitcoin is inclusive. To buy some, you only need access to a phone or computer with an internet connection, or visit a grocery store with a Bitcoin ATM. It is significantly harder to invest in stocks or get a bank account, especially for those who aren't already socioeconomically privileged. The global poor can safely hold whatever wealth they have in Bitcoin without worrying about that wealth being devalued as a result of increased supply. Bitcoin is resistant to seizure, which also benefits those who flee oppressive regimes with their life savings. Cash is bulky and gold is heavy. Authorities and thieves detect and confiscate both. How does one get their life savings to their new country? One solution for many has been to keep Bitcoin in a digital wallet with a memorized seed phrase. To do this, one memorizes a string of 12 random words which can be used to unlock their Bitcoin savings when they arrive safely at their destination. And would-be thieves have no idea which random person traveling through an airport has such a wallet. Bitcoin can also help solve problems in countries with healthier economies, including the US, my home country. I'll talk about three: credit, banking, and storing value. First, credit. Credit is a tool to build wealth. People who can borrow to, for example, buy homes or start companies, can then pay back the debt slowly as the currency devalues. But those who need it most get it the least. U.S. history has shown that credit is not extended equitably. The clearest example is redlining, where the federal government color-coded neighborhoods in terms of willingness to loan at various interest rates, and for those color-coded red, the Federal Housing Administration refused to insure mortgage loans to people living in those neighborhoods. These were primarily lower-income black people living in urban areas. This locked lower-income black families out of home ownership, which is the primary vehicle for rising to the middle class. Redlining was banned in 1968, but its effects are still seen today. Black families own 1% of the wealth in America today. They owned 0.5% in 1863, when the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. White families today have nearly 10 times the net worth of black families, and more than 8 times that of Hispanic families. Being shut out of the credit market is economically devastating, and so people seek credit elsewhere. Each year, 12 million Americans, 6% of American adults, take out a payday loan, making it a multi-billion dollar industry. The average loan is $375, and the average loanee pays $520 in interest. People deserve a vehicle to store the fruits of their labors. Bitcoin can fill the gap now, even as we fight for a more equitable and just system for all. The second problem is a lack of banking. Over 7 million U.S. households were unbanked as of 2019. Unbanked people pay to cash their paychecks, to get money orders to pay rent and utilities, to get prepaid debit cards, and so on. The average unbanked family pays $2,400 a year on financial transactions like these alone, a whopping 10% of their annual income. The unbanked pay approximately $89 billion per year in total transaction fees. Bitcoin mitigates both the banking and borrowing problems in the U.S. In relation to banking, it's important to note that the unbanked still have income, but it comes in the form of checks that cost money to cash. Bitcoin costs nothing to receive and about $10 to send. And with protocols like Lightning that run on top of the Bitcoin network, the cost per transaction is pennies. If unbanked people were paid in Bitcoin and could pay bills in Bitcoin, the cost of their financial transactions would be minuscule, and they can easily and cheaply convert some of their Bitcoin to US dollars if they so desire. Bitcoin can also help those who have turned to payday loans. Such a loanee is often unbanked, and remember, the unbanked pay about $2,400 per year in transaction fees. Cutting those transaction fees to less than a dollar per year would mean that they'd keep the equivalent of $200 per month. Since the average payday loan borrower is only about $26 short per month, a significant majority of those who take out payday loans would no longer need to do so. They could avoid this predatory industry altogether. So much for banking and credit. Finally, consider storing value. There are systemic factors that make it difficult for people who aren't already wealthy to store value. Regulators tend to think that for people's own good, they shouldn't be allowed to make risky investments, except the lottery, apparently. So the rich get richer because of their access to stable stores of value, like hedge funds, venture capital investments, and so on, and the poor do not. Holding Bitcoin at least keeps their money safe in a currency that won't devalue due to increased supply. One might think that holding cash in a savings or checking account isn't risky. First, not everyone can open a savings account. Bitcoin is more inclusive. Second, savings accounts aren't risky in this sense. Your money will be there when you need it. But they are risky in another sense. Your savings will be less valuable when you take it out. $100 in 1950 is worth $1,080 today. By holding US dollars for 60 years, it loses $1,000 in value. Bitcoin, by contrast, has gained value every year of its existence, save one, and it has gotten less volatile every year. And of course, one needn't save only in Bitcoin. People deserve a vehicle to store the fruits of their labors. Some people have access to many such stores of wealth, but those who need them most tend not to. Bitcoin can fill the gap now, even as we fight for a more equitable and just system for all. All right, and that does it for the rich get richer and the poor get Bitcoin. Let's take a second for our sponsor, and I want to do a guy's take on this piece. The Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. You know about it at this point if you've been listening to the show, but the holidays are coming up. Tell me that you don't have that friend or family member or somebody that you know who has Bitcoin but isn't holding their keys. It is time to give them the gift of sovereignty. Get them a secure hardware wallet where they can hold their keys. But it's really important when you do this to get them one that is easy to use, one that doesn't scare the crap out of them. Easy usually means custodial. Luckily, in this case, the Bitbox O2 is an exception to the rule. It is completely sovereign. It is open source. It is secure. Yet it has an intuitive desktop and mobile app on Android to accompany it, and the backup takes just seconds on a micro SD card. It is a very easy to set up and easy to use intuitive hardware wallet. This is the perfect device for beginners, and as a Bitcoiner in their life, it's probably your job, your responsibility to help them know what they are doing and teach them how to keep that Bitcoin safe. I know it is, at least for people in my life. Get them a Bitbox O2, 5% off using code GUY at checkout. Head straight there at guyswan.com/bitbox. Great little piece by Bradley Rettler here. And it really drives home some of the simplest, I guess, benefits that Bitcoin can bring to the demographic that is most underserved by the legacy system. And it's really kind of a bad joke how serious the inequities are in the rules and the access available within the traditional financial system. And, you know, it actually reminds me, you know, somebody actually asked after Nick Carter, we just recently got back from the Oslo Freedom Forum that was in Miami, and Nick Carter did a short presentation, really good, on the activist history, the cypherpunk history of Bitcoin, and what led to the ideas of Bitcoin. How was this essentially a product of freedom fighters and freedom lovers on the internet? And afterward, I got up there with him, and we had a short discussion and a Q&A with a couple of questions from the audience. And somebody from the audience actually asked a question that I think is kind of relevant here in explaining what kind of equality Bitcoin can bring and why it will actually help to eliminate the current growing wealth gap. So she was, or it sounded like she was from Belarus, and she was talking about that in Belarus, the dictator was actually mining Bitcoin, which I did not know this. Or at least that was the way she worded the question. So maybe it was even a hypothetical. I didn't think about it. But anyway, the dictator of Belarus could mine Bitcoin. Let's assume in this case that they are mining Bitcoin, since that's the way she worded it. And that he would get very, very wealthy from doing so, and then would be able to use this wealth again to, instead of to help free the people, that it would be used to further enslave them. It would be the very wealth needed to pay for the infrastructure and the enforcement to keep them stuck. So how does Bitcoin help them? The reason I think this is an interesting question is because Bitcoin does not and cannot discriminate. So if it benefits the poor, it will also benefit the wealthy. But the poor are very, very disproportionately benefited because the wealthy have access to tools like this already. The wealthy have access to the legacy banking system. The wealthy can easily and always do buy assets that go up in value. In fact, the very reason they go up in value is because they can issue debt in order to buy assets. They're literally printing money to inflate the price of assets so that they have a return, which is then being used to justify the printing of more money. It's literally a cycle of fake numbers. The major problem in our system, the current system, isn't simply that people are wealthy, that there's too many wealthy people. It's that there are too many wealthy people who get wealthy without creating any wealth. In a free market, with all else equal, and just ignoring fraud and theft, which obviously are violations of any sort of voluntary agreement, the only way to get wealthy in a free market is by creating and trading value. It is by offering value and productivity in exchange for that same value from others. So to get wealthy in a free market is the very process of creating more value than you consume at a very, very high volume. But that is not at all the case in our current system. When the financial system specifically is hugely exclusionary to just an enormous part of the population, when being wealthy actually means having the right subsidies, having the right regulatory environment for you, cozying up to the right politicians, when the very rules of the game are not equal, what happens is that the poor are in a position where they are forced to play the game, not to mention that they are already from a hugely disadvantaged position, but they are forced to play strictly within the rules, while the rich just play the refs. They don't have to play the sport. They don't have to play the soccer game. They just play the politicians. They play the subsidies. They play the regulators, because there's so much power and so much influence that a lobbying dollar is worth more than a productive dollar. They just have to partner with the owners of the game, the government and the politicians, And then suddenly they just get to have the rules apply to them only when, you know, it looks nice. Maybe not for the next few days. Maybe they just need to get a boatload of scores. They just need a whole bunch of points, even though they never actually got the ball through into the goal. But because, you know, they're just too important as players of the game. They really need 10 points. It's just, they just do. Come on, they're going to lose otherwise. That would be terrible. They're the most important players, obviously. So the refs just give it to them. The game owners just change the rules right now so that it's not about trade. It's just about, I'm just going to print trillions and trillions of dollars and I'm just going to hand it out to whoever just seems important enough to need it right now. That absolutely obliterates everything that makes the free market the free market. The only reason a market works is because every decision is a voluntary trade. Every exchange has skin in the game. It has two consenting participants who are judging the relative value of that trade, that TV for the money they worked their ass off for, those braces at the expense of not getting the TV that they want. Everybody has a trade-off. Everybody has skin in the game because the money is equal in value to each person. The rules for acquiring it are the same for each person. As soon as you have an institution that is just creating this out of thin air, it is corrupting everything about the free market by making it more profitable to just be near them when they're handing out dollars than actually doing something in the market. That is not a free market. That is corruption through and through to the bone. So he brings up actually in this piece that the United States government printed $9 trillion in 2020, and that this was 22% of all the US dollars ever minted. I think if you compare it to the M2 money supply rather than the fully printed, or maybe ever minted, I don't know, I'm not 100% sure where that statistic gets from, because I'm pretty sure it's 40% of the total M2 money supply is $9 trillion. And that's kind of what I refer to as the relevant money supply when we're talking about inserting $9 trillion into the economy. But I just want to talk about for 1 second, I've mentioned this before on the show, but what does it mean to print $9 trillion out of thin air in a free market? So again, I'll reiterate just the general concept of a free market. The reason the free market works is because the aggregate success or failure of each single institution or business or person is dependent on the value, the ability to trade voluntarily, to have people come to them to get that excess value they create on a voluntary basis. And the reason that trade is meaningful is because every other person only got that trade, only got that wealth, that ability to determine whether or not this store goes out of business or stays in business, whether they go to the store to get their goods or their TV or their braces or their gas, whatever it is, that they provided a good enough service that they took the person A took the money that they worked for, that they had to actually have someone else agree to trade with them, that they had to have somebody who actually wanted them to come into their business and help them produce goods and services for someone else because they were valuable. And then they took that. They took that with skin in the game. They knew how many hours it took to earn that. They knew the blood, sweat, and tears. They knew the trade-offs to not take a vacation, but instead save a little bit of money that went into their decision to spend at this store versus this one, to spend on this phone instead of this other one, or to just skip 3 generations of phone because, you know, my 7 is good enough. Those decisions matter. They're absolutely critical. And when you build $9 trillion worth of activity off of skin in the game trade, off of everybody making real value judgments based on the blood and the sweat that they had to expend to get their value, they're careful. They are careful about where it is sent to. They know that what they actually spend that capital on is going to help them, that they want it, that it is worth it to them. Because otherwise, they throw all of that work and sacrifice into the garbage. So again, what does it mean to, without any of that work, without any of those trade-offs, without any underlying true understanding or skin in the game about what it is worth, what does it mean to print $9 trillion and to hand it out? The average person earns $2 million over their lifetime. That's not that much. $2 million over their lifetime. And all of that is their ability to direct the market in one way or another. If they always spent that $2 million on a more reliable, slightly more expensive, but higher quality product, then that's $2 million to supporting those companies, those brands, those businesses. And then somebody else may spend all $2 million of that dollars on cheap, frivolous crap that breaks quickly. That's all of their input is that $2 million. And in aggregate, you get the output. You get which companies survive and which don't based on all of those judgments. To print $9 trillion in a year and give it to whoever is politically connected enough, can file the form fast enough, or whoever it is to completely erase the economic effect, the free market pressures of 4.5 million people from existence. Birth to death, they no longer exist in the free market. They no longer had any say whatsoever which of those product lines was more likely to succeed. They didn't matter at all. It was all stolen from them in a matter of months by the United States government. Their economic existence is now meaningless. Someone who wants to address inequality and does not address that problem is someone who is trying to repaint the trim in an apartment building that is engulfed in flames. It is completely pointless. The ability to print money is the greatest source of inequality in the world today. And the ability for the wealthy and already politically connected to access that wealth when the poor and middle classes cannot grows that gap consistently over time. The wealth inequality has continued to do nothing but grow since the 1970s. And it is no coincidence that in the early 1970s, 1971, we got off the gold standard, and the restriction, the single pressure restriction to prevent the government from printing too much money, disappeared forever. Bitcoin is 21 million. Bitcoin levels the playing field completely. It creates a new game where the refs are automated. The refs literally cannot cheat. The refs literally have no idea which player is which. It does not know and cannot care. All the ref can do is judge the rules in a completely unambiguous, perfectly auditable network. The rules of the game are programmed, and there is no master who can change those rules. So even if someone with lots of wealth, someone with tons of social influence, moves into Bitcoin, they start mining Bitcoin or they start buying Bitcoin, they will still have that wealth and social influence. But the unjust means of acquiring wealth in the future no longer exists. It only exists in the fiat world. Bitcoin is immune to it. They will get over to Bitcoin and suddenly find out that they actually have to be good at soccer, because the refs can't bail them out anymore. They can only be bailed out in the dollar game, but the Bitcoin game doesn't play that way. It's simply not possible. There are 21 million, the rules are perfectly clear and auditable, and there are no masters. There is no company to rule over. Everyone owns and operates the network together. The rules simply exist, and you either follow them or the network doesn't let you in. This solves the seed of inequality that is so powerful in our society today. It does not, well, it is actually kind of redistributing wealth because particularly the middle class and the poor are getting into Bitcoin at a higher degree and always have because kind of the wealthy elite, the yuppie elite, so to speak, don't really have any reason to think that Bitcoin should work. It's outside of their worldview. Though I wish, particularly with the financialization of the Bitcoin market in the last few years, I really wish that trend would continue. I really wish the, not the financialization trend, but the trend of the middle class and the poor getting into Bitcoin at higher numbers, understanding the value proposition of Bitcoin better. And maybe that's partly up to us to get the word out, but it is a little upsetting or disheartening to see kind of the upper middle class and the wealthy markets of the United States start to take a big interest in Bitcoin when there are still so many poor and middle class who have not, especially when they disproportionately benefit to a huge degree. You know, like I said, the wealthy have always have had access to assets that go up in price. The wealthy have transaction tools and easy ways to move through the banking system with large amounts of money. The wealthy can get as much credit as they dream up at near zero interest rate. But the people who really need it are the ones who can't even get included in the game. They can't buy any assets because they're not in the right club. They don't have enough money. They're not an accredited investor. There are literally barriers. There are literally like brackets of investing that quote unquote normal people just aren't allowed to do. That they're not legally allowed to do. That's so stupid. Bitcoin does not and cannot care. Everybody in the world can go download themselves a Bitcoin wallet. They can all invest. They can all save. And not a single one of them will print more Bitcoin. There will never be more than 21 million in existence. And it is produced at a perfectly predictable, predetermined rate. You know, there's a quote in this one, actually. Where is it? The wealthy... Okay, so this is a quote from the article here. It says, quote, "The wealthy also easily take on low-interest debt in a currency that gets easier to pay back over time and use it to buy assets that hold or increase their value. The poor cannot. They have less access to low-interest debt and so pay off debts less easily." So we are currently in an environment where literally corporate loans are given at near zero interest rate. The cost of capital for the wealthy is near zero, where credit card debt, where debt for the lowest income brackets are still paying 20%, 25% interest rates. But why do corporations, why is there no price of debt for the wealthy? You know, really, when you think about it, in a natural market, it should actually be easier for someone with very small amounts of wealth to make larger returns on it. Whereas someone who's some corporation or whatever that's already huge, it's actually harder for them to scale. They become less nimble. They become less able to adapt. And another $1 million on top of all the millions that they have might not necessarily... easily produce any extra value than what they were already getting. Maybe an example of the illustration of this principle is that it's far more profitable to invest in developing countries than developed countries. The return on that investment is much, much greater if you invest in a poor country that is growing. And you see this with us outsourcing, the United States outsourcing so much to the developing world. The businesses and so many of the workers and all of these sorts of things, because when the land around it is worth $5 and you can increase the value of that land to $10,000, that's a huge return on investment. Whereas if you're in a neighborhood where the land is, or a location where the land is already, this plot of land is already worth $1 million, you put something really nice on it and put a lot of infrastructure and stuff and make it good, it might be worth like $110 million. You know, like it just, it's the magnitude, the degree of the change is not going to be as great in a place that already has infrastructure, that already has a bunch of nice shit in all the other plots of land around it. So why is it that it's basically costless for corporations and massively wealthy people to get extraordinary amounts of debt in an economy that is in debt up to its eyeballs, that has so many multiples of debt versus actual productivity and value that it is staggering? It's the highest imbalance we've ever had in this country, ever in its history. How could it possibly be free? Because the cycle of printing the money as debt means the very act of printing the debt raises the prices of the stock market and the assets. The corporations are literally taking out loans at near 0% in order to buy back their stocks, which pump up the value of the corporation. That makes it appear like the debt paid off, which that extra value they can now leverage to get more 0% debt. The same goes for assets. The same goes for housing. Everything that is scarce. If you print money in order to fund the purchasing of it, because it goes up in value, you're producing the very imbalance that makes it go up in value to make it look like a good investment. And what you are doing is you are making the gap from the people who can get those assets and who can get that debt and the people who can't bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, because the inflation stays in the wealthy market. It stays in the places where the wealthy put their money. Inflation doesn't happen all at once. It's not like you print $100,000 or $1 trillion or something and everything just goes up by $3 today. No, it moves through the economy. You first give it to the bunch of corporations or the lobbyists or the people with the subsidies and the infrastructure projects and all of these things that the market didn't actually trade in real life for. They just got robbed. Everybody just got robbed of all of that time, value, and work that they put in, all the sacrifice of their lives, so that this project that they didn't actually trade for gets built, or that this company gets the bailout for that they had already left. They didn't want to do business with because they're fraudulent. Their business practices are garbage. That's why they were going to go out of business. They should go out of business. The money goes to them first. And then they bid up the prices of the assets and the stocks and the equities and the financial instruments that they purchase. It only goes up because people are bidding those prices up. So the first wave of price increases happen in all the assets and all the commodities and equities and financial instruments that the wealthy people who get the money want to buy. The stuff that's actually valuable over the long term. And you know who they're outbidding? The poor and the middle class. The very things that are most likely to hold their value and the very things that are most attractive to people in the wealthy class, because they are the things that the wealthy and educated people actually want to hold. They're the things of the most value, the things you actually want: a good retirement, a bond that pays out good interest rates, assets that don't lose value, all of these great things. These are exactly the things that are most likely to go up in value so that the poor can't afford them. And the way you can see the shift is actually by trying to measure things in the number of hours it takes in order to acquire these things. Mark Moss actually had a really great tweet the other day that I saved. It said in 1971, at the average hourly rate of $4, it took 625 hours of your life to buy the standard Ford F-150 truck. Today, the average hourly rate is $26, but it now takes 1,154 hours to get a standard F-150 truck. You see this same effect in everything that is largely purchased with debt. because our system as designed creates new money into existence as debt chasing these specific items. You see the same thing in houses, which is actually mostly because people treat it as an investment, but it's actually not an investment. A house is actually a huge liability that should not actually make people money unless they're renting it out. But it's the price system and the money has been so abused by the government that it's essentially forced the market to think of and treat houses like they're a savings account, but they're not. A house should not really go up in value unless the value of the area has significantly increased due to new growth and, you know, new productivity and, you know, whatever it is. But it should actually be more like a car, that it's just got a slower, much slower decline curve as a car, but it loses value over time. It requires more maintenance, you know, things break, stuff rots. But luckily for the CPI, what do you know? House prices were actually removed back in the 80s. So of course, inflation would look a little bit crazy right now if we were including house prices, if we were including everything, actually, that was largely purchased on debt. But it just so happens that those are generally the things that got removed from the CPI during the 80s and 90s. Change to the system. What do you know? But when interest rates are manipulated to nothing, when reserve requirements are sent to nothing, when interest rates are they're trying to push interest rates negative, when the cost of capital, of acquiring new capital, as in dollars, is essentially non-existent for the higher middle class and the wealthy class, when there's no risk or need to have some sort of significant return to pay off the credit risk, which is nothing if you got the capital for free. But even more so is the return doesn't need to be of anything of substance, because the very act of issuing the debt tends to raise the prices of those items most likely bought with debt. So the return of those items, the equities, the instruments that are granted to the wealthy and middle class, if you just get like a default return that is a no-brainer and your cost of capital is essentially nothing, why would you ever have to invest in something riskier or in a poor market that actually needs to be productive? If it takes a lot of risk and it's very difficult and costly to get the capital to make a return or be productive, well, then that decision as to where you allocate it is critical. It's insanely hard and a meticulous decision. But when the cost of capital is essentially free, all you kind of have to do is haphazardly throw it at anybody that's standing near scarce resources, and you're bound to make a return. And if you pay only 1% interest, or Jesus, maybe 0% interest, all they got to do is make 2. You're golden. All the while, they don't realize that the very nature of this system, the very creation of the money and debt that they are playing with, requires them to walk all over the poorest people in the country. Those that are forced to hold their dollars and watch the price of a house that they want to get that better life go 10% higher every single year, chasing the hope of a better future up a staircase without realizing that the financial and banking and monetary system has turned it into an escalator going down. It's no surprise they just get exhausted and just sit down and give up. Bitcoin turns the escalator in the reverse direction. It goes up in value, not down. And all that production and value that's being created by other people in the economy, it further increases the value of Bitcoin within that economy by having more goods and services against the same 21 million units. Everything there is divided by 21 million. Look that up on YouTube. Everyone is actively working to keep the escalator moving up with everybody else, so that saving $100 worth of Bitcoin, worth of real sound money today, might actually mean a lot more purchasing power. Not $90 next year, but $110, $120, maybe double. Instead of the price of your movie ticket going from $12 to $18, which has happened literally in the last year around me at the theaters that I go to, it goes from $12 to $10 to $8. Or maybe the better metric is it goes from 30,000 sats to 20,000 sats. Because it doesn't happen in dollars. It only happens in Bitcoin. And the ability to save, even just a little bit, is a huge game changer for people who live under conditions where $20, an extra $30 at the end of the year, can make a big difference. Where an extra $30 a month means the difference between having to go to a predatory paycheck lender and pay an exorbitant interest rate, or staying at zero, just making it through the month with a couple of dollars positive. I had no idea that that statistic Bradley Rettler hit, that the average payday loan borrower is just $26 short a month. That's really pretty crazy. Bitcoin can make up that difference. Bitcoin can bring down the walled gardens and the restrictions and the transaction fees of exactly the people who are stuck in that situation where that amount of money can make all the difference in the world. And everybody, everywhere, has the same access, the same wallets, the same keys, the same rules, and Bitcoin cannot discriminate. And with the Lightning Network, the ability to transact anywhere in the world instantly for essentially a non-existent cost, I don't think people appreciate just how much of an impact that could have on reversing the awful trend of inequality we have been stuck in for 50 years. Not just in this country, but literally all around the world. All right. That'll do it. Thank you guys so much for listening. Another great piece by Bradley Rettler. Always love it. And thank you for everyone who upvoted this piece on bitcoinaudible.com/vote. A huge thank you to Fold, to the Bitbox, and to Swan Bitcoin, our amazing sponsors for this show. Get somebody you care about who isn't holding their keys a Bitbox O2. Use Guy for 5% off. Sign up with the Fold card and start stacking sats with Swan Bitcoin. We've also actually got another. I now have a discount from Bitcoin Magazine. Guys, Bitcoin 2022 is going to be lit. It is going to be absolutely insane. I don't know if you got to go to Bitcoin 2021 or if you missed out on it, but I have got a discount code for you guys now. Code GUYSWAN, Swan with two N's, by the way, will get you 10% off your Bitcoin 2022 tickets. And I've got a redirect. You can go to b.tc/conference, but I just built a redirect in at guyswan.com/2022. Again, get 10% off and get your tickets sooner rather than later. They actually go up increasingly as we get closer to the date because, you know, they're more scarce. But it's coming up in April. And actually, you should go to guyswan.com/2022 just to see the freaking volcano lightning meme thing that they've got on the website. It's actually pretty cool looking. But yeah, check that out. Don't forget, you can get 10% off. Stoked to see everybody this year. It is going to be crazy. And, you know, Bitcoin, you know, the conference is an amazing thing, but it's because of how amazing Bitcoin is. You know, I when you look at this sort of thing and you see the magnitude of a problem that could be solved, we have the option of continuing to support the legacy system that is making this imbalance, that is causing this disease and suffering, or we can actually, we have the option to opt out into a system that actually has the ability to fix it, to relegate the manipulation of money as a tool for power and wealth to the pages of history. That is why I am here, and I hope you will join me in this journey. I am Guy Swan. This is Bitcoin Audible. And until next time, everybody, take it easy. This has been Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.